You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and today I have the great pleasure of speaking with someone who I don't know very much at all, named Michael Ashford. That name may be familiar to some people. He is a podcaster, a speaker, an author, a citizen journalist, a person attempting to do good in the world, and encourage others to do likewise. Michael, welcome, and thank you for showing up here. And I want to make sure to mention that podcast. The podcast is The Follow-Up Question, and you can find it, as far as I can tell, everywhere.
Everywhere. And, as we podcasters say, everywhere you get your podcasts.
Everywhere you get your podcasts, exactly. And he was, is it still up or is it down, that former podcast, the Dad's Fitness podcast?
Yeah, the Fit Dad Fitness podcast is no more. It's out there, like the shell of it is out there, but you can't get any of the episodes anymore.
Yeah. Well, sorry to disappoint anybody.
Yeah.
Look at that, but but that's not how I made contact or got into contact. Michael reached out to me after viewing one of my podcasts, I think, with Daryl Davis and Jeff Scoop.
Yes, sir.
Daryl Davis, the musician by training and extraordinary human being by birth, no doubt.
By nature, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And who has spent many years reaching out to connect with people who walk into that situation hating him, right? I mean, the Klan, the neo-Nazis, et cetera, et cetera. And Jeff Scoop, who was for 25 years the leader, head of director, I don't know what the title is, of the National Socialist Movement, was essentially the American Nazi Party, and no more. And in fact, is really helps people now get out of the movement, and he too tries to make connections, help people make connections with people who they might not otherwise do that. And so let me ask you. So what do you hope will come out of this conversation? I mean, we've just shared, we have many intersecting lines in our past.
We do.
Exactly. Well, so maybe we can start with the follow-up podcast. So you are by day a marketing executive, a marketer, yes. Right? You're head marketer for a software company. Well, I don't know when it happens, but you are also this enthusiastic podcaster, blogger, et cetera, writer, and speaker. Had a couple of TED Talks, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So the podcast, why and what's it about, and why did we start it?
Why the podcast? So let's go back to the summer of 2020. I'm sitting on the couch watching the nightly news with here in Denver with my wife, and we were watching at the time the riots that were happening all across the country, and including here in Denver, in the wake of the George Floyd murder. And you know, we're going through that. We're also going through, you know, every news story is either the riots or the presidential election, which was just like hateful and vitriolic and just like nasty. And then of course we were in the middle of a pandemic, so we were all shut off from each other. Right. And right. We were watching the nightly news and seeing, you know, seeing the angst, the anger, seeing the response to that from both sides, like some feeling that it was a cathartic moment for the U.S. and some feeling as if it was a threat to the U.S. and its democracy. I mean, depending on where you're coming from. And I was just talking with my wife about it, and I'm like, this feels really disappointing. This feels really deflating because I don't think this is who we actually are. Like when I talk to people face to face, it doesn't ever get to this point. Like, yeah, emotions may run high, but it never gets to the point where like we're fighting, we're enemies of each other. And me being the former journalist and the millennial that I am, I was like, I have no idea what to do. I'll just start a podcast. So that's how the follow-up question started, which was, I want to do what I know how to do best, which is ask questions, which is interview people, going back to my journalism days, my journalism roots. And I want to get people from all different walks of life, all different perspectives, I want to record my conversation with them and see if there's a way, if there are common threads that we can establish in just hearing people's stories, like getting beyond the Twitter 280 characters and getting down into the deep nuance and complexity of who people are, with a theory that if I did that, I could help us see that we're not as divided as we appear to be. And I think I've accomplished that. Like if over the course of, you know, coming up on 110 episodes of the show as we record this, David, I think that is coming to light. I think that's true. What I don't think is true is I don't think we like that at first pass. The idea of finding common ground with people we disagree with, like people don't like it. So I've had to kind of switch gears a little bit and talk more about, okay, maybe how do we communicate better across divides? Like let's maybe not lead with finding common ground. Let's just, how do we communicate through conflict better?
You just said, say more about the sort of people not wanting to find common ground. You mean your experience of at least a bunch of people, right? I mean, nothing's everything, but of at least a bunch of people is that they really want to hold, they're getting something from holding tight to their ideas, principles, tribal affiliation, whatever it is, right? They're getting something from that.
For sure.
So what do you think they're getting from that? other than charged up?
yeah. They're getting, you hit on the tribal part. And that to me is really, really critical, because to go and seek common ground with someone who your tribe has labeled other or the enemy or not like us, to go and seek common ground with those people is dangerous to you and your standing within your tribe. And your tribe could be your social media friend group or acquaintances. It could be your family. It could be your coworkers. I mean, whoever you define your tribe as, the people you ideologically align with, to lead with that curiosity and go and say, hey, you and I disagree, but I want to try and find ways that we can work together. We've been so conditioned by a lot of the people who I used to call colleagues in the journalism world, especially at the national level. I don't consider them journalists, actually. I call them media entertainers. But they have there are people that profit off of conflict, entrepreneurs who profit off of our conflict, profit off of us staying in our tribes, profit off of us not trying to seek common ground and have constructive dialogue with each other when we disagree.
Yeah.
So,
drama sells. Absolutely.
Yeah,
it sells.
It is. It's a protective measure. It feels safe to stay in your tribe and not go seek common ground with other people. So
did you have you had experiences on your podcast where you were trying to talk with people and it ended up being they don't really want any part of it?
Thankfully, no.
No, that's good.
Thankfully, no. Yeah, more in the context of trying to build a following for that show has been difficult. I've made sure that I've brought people onto the show who I know are willing to go there with me.
Right.
We don't always agree. An assumption that I sometimes fight with my show that I've heard from people is that everyone that I bring on my show, I agree with them on everything. And I simply don't.
Mm-hmm.
In one of my TEDx talks, I reference a conversation that I had with a man named Andy Norman, who coincidentally, I just scheduled today his follow-up episode with. He's coming back to the show. But I'm a lifelong Christian. Andy is an atheist. And we had a fantastic conversation. I was really, really nervous and uncomfortable leading up to that conversation with Andy,
really?
Because a lot of his ideas challenged me in ways that were, yeah, uncomfortable. Like he doesn't believe in the things that I believe in. His my faith, he believes, is kind of like a mind virus. But I had to press into that conversation.
Yeah,
I had to. And he and I have so much respect for each other. Like, I respect him and his ability to think through and be open to that conversation every bit as much as, and he's told me this, he respects my willingness to go there with him too.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't trying to change Andy's mind in that conversation. And like I said, I'm bringing him back because he's got something to say. Mm-hmm. We do have common ground, but absolutely, conversations have been challenging for me. I don't agree with everything, but the people that I do bring on are at least willing to go there with me.
And why do you think that is an impediment? Well, maybe it's just the answers itself. Because you said in building a following for the show, that's been a challenge. And is that simply because, you know, we live in a world where conflict sells? I mean, people want, I mean, I know I run into that as well. I mean, and the people that say, you know, you could have asked this question, like, you know, to get, and I was like, look, this is not about gotcha.
You're right.
It's not about trying to find where's the soft underbelly that I can strike at. It's about, you know, you said it a moment ago, right? I mean, it's people telling their stories and people listening to other people's stories. It's an unbelievable, as far as I'm concerned, an untapped wealth of just gems, right? Just all this treasure, not all of it that you necessarily want, but boy, there's a lot of intelligence in every direction that's untapped, just embedded in people's stories. And that absolutely, I'm sorry for that. I have this on. I have this on because I have a camera that I'm going to have to restart at one point because it only goes for 30 minutes.
I've been there before.
Yeah, exactly.
So you hit on something there, David, though. Your show, Curiosity Invited, you're inviting people to dig in and follow their curiosity about others. And that is not something that we are often incentivized. That is not modeled for us in a lot of our culture today.
Yeah.
It's not how we're taught. We're taught to be certain. It is modeled to us to be certain, to have a stance, to hold steady to that. And if you waver from that, then you're a flake, right?
Right. You're wishy-washy.
Yeah. I mean, did you name your show Curiosity Invited?
Yeah.
What was the impetus for that?
Well, for me, it was, you know, I've been in education. Most of my professional career was in education. Started a school, ran a school, teacher, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you know, at some point, just looking at the world, looking at the demographics, looking at the speed at which things are moving, idea that we can prepare people now for their future became absurd. That realization that the world is moving at a speed was, so then what is the goal of education? And for me, it was, the answer was, you know, to teach people to be curious about their world, to genuinely be curious about their world, about other people, about things they love and about things they don't love, and, you know, to ask questions of themselves, of the stuff, of the information, to ask questions. That's the, you know, that's the only way you can be prepared to, like, you know, that we used to tell the kids, like, look, we want you to know what to do when you don't know what to do. Like, what do you do when you don't know what to do?
Ooh, that's good.
I mean, isn't that what education is? Because how am I gonna, like, if I could teach you everything you're gonna know, but you're gonna walk into just like you have in your career, whichever one of your careers it is like, and you're gonna walk into something you've, unless you're really unlucky and have one of those jobs that, you know everything in advance. It's like you're gonna come in face to face over and over with situations. You've never seen one of those before. So what do you do when you don't know what to do? And that's the, so curiosity was, it's the goal, right?
I love it. What's interesting is for so long, what you just described, David, has been labeled as the soft skills.
Yes, right.
And it's been treated almost as if it were, oh yeah, like those wishy-washy things.
Right.
My belief is it's because there's no right answer. It's been avoided because there's no way to be certain about what to do when you don't know what to do. I mean, we all just literally went through 2.5 years of not knowing what to do.
Exactly.
Right. And look at how many different responses there were to that situation.
Yeah.
And how many people, so much of it, from my vantage point, just kind of taking a step back, so many people looking for certainty in a time and a place and in an environment and an experience where there was none to be found.
Yes.
And that really, really sent some people into some dark places.
Absolutely. And I think exactly what you're speaking about, that had more people sort of grown up with a value for being curious about the ever-changing world, you know, there would not have been so, because what's, you know, so often the refrain of the people who are really angry about that is that they lied to us. They told us this, but first, not, there's no reason to wear a mask. Then you have to wear a mask. Then it turns out masks are not, then only a mask is, and it's like, you know, they were lying to us. It was like, well, no. You know, the way the world works sometimes, maybe some people were lying, but like you find out more information and then you change your mind because you now have more information. And that concept, I think, as you just said, it's not how we were taught to be. Where's the certainty?
The ability to change your mind.
Right.
The freedom and space to change your mind and be okay with that and say, look, based on new information that I have.
Right.
I now believe this differently, or I now do. One of my favorite examples of this, I was in line at the post office. It would have been December 2021, kind of in an upswing of the pandemic. Actually, December 2020, upswing of the pandemic. Things were getting bad going into the holiday season. I was in line at the post office. It was like 30 people deep, and we were all, of course, 6 feet apart, masked and everything. There was a guy in there who was just ripping into the post office manager. He had mailed a package, apparently a couple weeks beforehand. I could hear everything because he was yelling that loud. And he was mad because it hadn't been delivered on time. And I think most people would see that and immediately, what I've experienced in my case anyway, a lot of people would look at that and label that person as an instigator or a troublemaker, or, you know, who does that guy think he is? Like, he's a jerk. He's wasting everyone's time. He's ripping into this guy who doesn't even have anything to do with this package that he mailed. And I initially had those thoughts, but then I'm sitting back here and I'm thinking, okay, let's take a survey of what's going on here. We are in an incredibly unknown time in our life. He's out in public. The thing that he mailed, maybe it was something really, really important that he had to get to his family. And so this is where my mind went. Either he's like nervous about being out in public because of everything that's going on, and he's had to stand in this line now for 30 minutes. his issue just kind of boiled as he had to wait more and more and more. And he's nervous and none of us knew what to do. So it could go there. But then I was like, you know, maybe that thing that he mailed was like the memento of a family member that who passed away from COVID. And they were in another state. I think it was Ohio, and we're here in Colorado, from what I could hear. And he's not able to attend the funeral service. Like, I wasn't able to attend the funeral service of my own grandmother that year. I had to watch my grandmother, my dear sweet grandmother's funeral service over Zoom. And so I'm just thinking through, like, how could I have a little bit of grace for this guy? Yes, maybe he's showing up in a highly emotionally charged way, but what could be true about his life that he would show up like that? I don't think that's who we are by default. We've got to consider the other circumstances going on around us. And that to me is a frustrating part of what I see when I see all the people either swinging far, far to the one side of the pendulum where it's everybody needs to wear a mask and I'm gonna yell and throw down if I see you not wearing a mask, all the way over to they're lying to us, like kind of like what you said, they're lying to us, they're changing their stories just to keep us down. It's a dictatorship.
Yes.
It's these things where I just wish we would take a step back and understand, like, people are going to respond in different ways because none of us have ever lived through this before. We just haven't. And we got to give some grace to each other for our responses, for the emotion that comes to the surface, and dig in and start asking questions of ourselves, about them, of them. Like, go and actually engage in a conversation with somebody you disagree with. And if you don't have somebody in your network who you can go and ask questions of who disagrees with you, your network is not big enough. You're living in a bubble.
Right, yeah. I really like that piece in your talk where that was the one of the talks that I saw.
Yeah,
where that was the focus, is, you know, if you're surrounded by, I mean, and you know, there's fabulous to be surrounded by people who love you, and everything you do, everything that comes out of your mouth, they think is gold, and they just, and that's a wonderful thing. And if that's the entirety of your life, well, you know, maybe you need to step out a little bit, because
I heard it put this way. Is your goal to vent or actually solve a problem? Because if your goal is just to vent, then yeah, you need people in your life who you can just have a beer or have a glass of wine with and just rail on, like, the problems that you see. We all need that outlet. We all need that release. Okay. It's a good thing. But if that's all you do, if that's all your interactions, and you're complaining about the same problem over and over and over again, and you don't have anyone to go to help solve problems, then you know you've got maybe a constricted worldview a little bit.
In a situation like, here's the guy going off in the post office, and he's pissed and he's angry and he's upset and he's all sorts of things and he's loud and he's, so what to do? I mean, do you think we all have a role in that? Is the manager only have a role in that? What does one do in a situation like that?
Oh, I've never been asked that question, David. That's a great one.
We can cut it out if you want.
No. Keep it in. I love it. Yeah. I've actually, because this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately, is like, what is our place to step into those situations? Monica Guzman. I don't know if you know her.
Yeah.
She wrote
Braver Angels. Yeah,
Braver Angels. She wrote the book. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
One of the things that she wrote about and that we've talked about is getting an understanding of the context of the situation, and if the conversation can be had in the most effective way in that situation. Obviously, in that post office scene, if he had gotten physically abusive or violent, as a guy who works out and lifts and takes care of himself, I would have stepped up. let's be clear there. I would have stepped in. But for that kind of emotion, for that kind of situation and scenario, I felt, and I do agree with Monica on this, that the situation for having that conversation was not ideal. We were in line waiting for all these other people were waiting. Emotions were of all the other people in line were rising, getting irritated. And so for me to have any real effect beyond just letting him say what he needs to say and get out of there, I'm not sure I would have been able to contribute much help.
Yeah.
In that instance, I thought the post office manager's response was great. He was just like, he listened. He was like, I will do what I can. Give me your phone number. I will call you if we can track this down. I don't know where it's at, but I will do my best to find it. And, you know, I think probably that night that guy went home and was like, yeah, it was probably a little too much. Yeah,
I was kind of an asshole.
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah.
Well, I need to apologize. Maybe
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure what I could have brought to help that situation. So what Monica advocates for is taking stock of our ability to speak to that person in a way that can de-escalate the situation. If it's a really public forum, for instance, on social media, I'm probably not going to solve much issues on social media. There's nothing I can do in that situation at the post office to really de-escalate. I'm just a guy in a mask, five people deep, trying to mail a letter.
I mean, I think that there's real wisdom in that. Look, everything is contextual, and sometimes the context does not lend itself to a more thoughtful conversation.
Yeah.
Putting on a cape and, you know, running around town trying to de-escalate is maybe that's a job for a superhero. But
the hardest thing to do is to gauge, like, how much trust can I build with this person right away.
Right.
And in some instances, maybe that is true. You've got to gauge things like the emotion being displayed, how much time you can possibly devote to trying to build trust, because that is the bedrock of trying to solve any problem. I'm not going to solve any problem. You're not going to solve any problem if trust has not been established first. Mm. And getting an accurate gauge of, in the next 5 minutes that I'm in line with this guy, can I establish trust that will de-escalate the situation, that will just get him? Because what's my goal too? I just want to get him out of line, or do I want to have him treat the store manager better? I don't know. But that is also something that, you know, you kind of got to take. There's some nuance to it. Can I build trust while not making everybody else around me mad that I'm just taking up time in line?
It used to be just that guy. Now it's both of these guys.
Now they're both going at it.
I have an appointment.
I don't know. And that's the most frustrating part, I think, probably about the work that we do, is how often we have to say, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing, the work that we do. So your work is, you think of what you're doing as work. I don't mean that as work, you know, in that as if it's drudgery, but it's a meaningful contribution. You're doing something in the world that is, I think I said it when, like, he's a person who's attempting to do good in the world and help others do that as well. And I think that's true. And what a great job that would be
to have
in this world, right? You know, somebody whose job is to contribute. And wouldn't that be nice if we all saw that as,
yeah,
that was at least our second job,
right?
First,
right, now it's kind of a hobby for me. it's a very public hobby, driven by a desire and a want to see us relate to each other better, to see us communicate better with each other. I think we just have not been taught how to communicate well with each other.
Yeah, and you know, we collectively are going through such a peculiar time for that, right? Between the pandemic, the 2016 and 2020 elections, and the, you know, I don't blame it on Trump, but his, you know, he didn't create. Well, he helped create, but he revealed stuff that was invisible for years, and the full expression of that is still happening. And that's really, it's challenging, and I mean, and good for you to like feel like, you know, to sort of see the trauma of all of that and say, look, gotta try to do something.
Hold it off. And you're right. I think he revealed and exposed a lot of simmering angst that, let me be clear on this, because I have many family members and many friends who voted for Donald Trump for very legitimate, good, real reasons, that for years of not feeling as if they were heard or allowed to speak those feelings, you can read and, you know, you can say allowed to by whom, but anyway, they're not bad people. I don't believe the majority of them are bad people.
I think
they had very real reasons that were left simmering too long, and it just took somebody with that level of bombastic personality who really didn't give a crap about what anybody else was going to say about him to lift that lid off the pot and just like, and then like stir it up a little bit more.
Okay.
There's a lot of people across the political spectrum who make a living doing exactly what he did.
Yes.
He just happened to be in the highest office in the country.
And I think that's right. And not that we want to get into a conversation about the political, well, who knows, but, you know, takes a certain person to make that sort of mess in a kitchen and not give a shit about cleaning it up or even helping clean it up. And so I mean, that's the piece that is troubling to me. Is like,
I lived with five guys in a house in college. There are people who will not clean up a kitchen after they made a mess.
So in addition to this podcast, to your podcast, which I think is a great thing, and you are also writing a book or have written a book?
I'm in the editing stages right now. I'm literally right now my editing is I'm reading it out loud to myself, and I have my red pen that I'm marking up a physical copy that I printed out. So that's what's going on right now.
and what is the book about, or do you not want to speak about that? But
no, we absolutely can. If you've seen my TEDx talks, my first TEDx talk, which was called Can I Ask a Question? That's the title of the book. And it is, my first TEDx talk is kind of like the intro to the book. I expand on it quite a bit, obviously, because it's a book and there's more, and I don't have 15 minutes of time devoted to it. And my second TEDx talk is like the final chapter. And so the book is filling in all the gaps between my first TEDx talk of how do we find common ground? How do we how do we get curious and follow our curiosity about other people, and to try and solve problems, to try and build bridges, going through all the steps there of what I call the psychology of conflict communication, leading us to answering the question of why. Like, why do we want to do this? Why do we want to find common ground? Why do we want to build bridges with people we disagree with and have complex, nuanced dialogue? Well, my second TEDx talk was all about, I believe we want peace in our lives. Mm. How we go about finding and creating that peace is the difference between actually experiencing it and having kind of a specter of peace in our lives. There's a big difference there. So that's the book.
what does that mean, the specter of peace? What do you mean by that?
I think there are a lot of things that we do that create this illusion of peace that are not actually peace. So when we, and I hate using this term, but when we cancel someone, that's not creating peace. That's not creating lasting peace. That's just saying, right. Yeah. That's just saying, I'm not going to pay attention to you anymore. Right. Like that's not changing. When we ghost someone after, let's say, a job interview or a relationship or a friendship, that's creating an artificial peace. When we only watch or consume content from our point of view, that's creating an artificial peace, because it doesn't actually solve any problems. Like it doesn't actually do anything to help solve the thing that you are fighting for, in a lot of ways, on the flip side, fighting against, because you always know that in the background, that problem still exists. That's the specter of peace. It's not real. We're withdrawing from all the things that make us uncomfortable, thinking that that's going to take care of the problem. And all it does is it simmers, it festers, it until it eventually boils over when somebody comes along and takes the lid off the pot.
Well, I have a couple of questions. One is, why are you concerned about these things, right? I mean, so what? I get that, you know, you're watching the protests on TV, and you're talking to your wife, and you know, it's like, but what do you have any insight into where that strand of who you are came from that is concerned about this? Because you could live a life of, you know, you could cloister yourself in a particular way and avoid those people that, you know, et cetera. So where'd that come from?
God, I love this question, David. I mentioned, you know, earlier that I have a lot of family who, you know, I lived in Kansas, red state, a lot of Republicans. I grew up a Republican. When I met my wife, here's one of the major issues that got me thinking in this way. My wife, shortly after we were married, got a job as an advocate at a domestic violence shelter. She was a case manager and advocate for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. And to me, I had gone my entire life, you know, looking from the outside in, saying, you know, why would a woman stay in that situation? Why would she not just leave? She's got all the services and capabilities to do that, not understanding the deep trauma, the deep complexity of those decisions, and the ways that it is not just that snap easy decision for a woman to leave an abusive relationship. And my wife's hearing the stories that my wife would come home from work and tell me about, that radically shifted the way I saw the issue, the way that I saw the responsibility in those scenarios of who should be responsible for getting women out of violent relationships, for instance. Even just the fact that I, you know, changing my language to domestic violence being a woman's issue to domestic violence is a men's issue, even that perspective shift, and her guiding me through that, got me thinking, what else do I don't know? Like, what other issues, if I was like this blind to the intricacies and the nuance of what it takes for a woman to leave an abusive relationship, and how systems are set up to make it so very difficult for her to do that, what else could I be missing? And so I started, that kind of got the ball rolling for me to get into this mindset of questioning, asking questions of myself and what it is that I believe and how I came to those beliefs. Like, one of the questions that I ask in my book is, the first time you ever voiced your political opinion on something, was it yours, or was it the makeup of your parents, your friends, people who served as a parental influence, your pastor? Like, whose political opinion was it? Was it something that you had come to yourself, or was it the makeup of other people's political opinions fueling into that? And I asked myself that question. I was like, oh yeah, this is like the first time I ever voiced that I was a Republican, I probably was 13, 14 years old. And I just said whatever my parents said or my grandparents said or like what I heard at church. But there's been some tricky conversations. There's been some moments where members of my family have, that hasn't set right with them.
Your political affiliation.
My shift in political affiliation.
Yeah.
But those conversations with my family, like, hurt, man. Feeling that judged, misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
Hurt. But those types of conversations, those relationships being strained in some ways, in the ways that they were over political affiliation, plus the conversation that I, or what I just mentioned with my wife and me asking these questions of myself, it is now, when you marry that with my training as a journalist and wanting to hear people's stories and knowing and believing that everyone has a story to tell, and that oftentimes my colleagues in journalism can manipulate a story based on the absence or removal of context and detail.
Mm.
That is not who I wanted to be.
Yeah, I get it.
I don't know if that answers your question, David. Like,
no, it's, well, you know, it's, you strike me as a person. Here's my really bad psychology. You strike me as a person that is willing may be the wrong word. You may be compelled to ask yourself questions and take both the question and the answer seriously. You know, it's that, it's anybody can get around any question if they really want to, and all. But there are some people who, you know, you ask a question or you hear something, and it's kind of like the thread on your sweater.
Yeah.
That you like, you know, you just, oh God, there's a thread, and you just sort of want to get rid of it. But it's one of those that sort of starts to unravel the sweater.
Because you keep picking at it.
Because it's this sweat. It's not just an errant thread. It's suddenly the whole sweater can start to come apart. And I think that's, you know, I think I long for a world in which more people do that, right? You know, really take their own questions and their own answers and other people's seriously. And
Me too. I know I sound exhausted and exasperated here, but it's a hope. It's not an exhaustion or an aspiration. Right. It's a hope, because I just know the quality of conversations and relationships that can be had when you approach division and divisiveness this way.
Yeah.
The thing that I have discovered the most in doing the follow-up question podcast and doing all the research and interviews that I've done for that show is the people who are best, are most willing and best able to have these difficult conversations are the people who have a level of self-awareness that they know that they can't possibly be right about everything 100% of the time. And so that unlocks their curiosity, because they say, well, if I know I can't be 100% right, what could I be wrong about? I want to find out. Mm-hmm. I want to find out. And they first do that by asking questions of themselves. They get introspective. They start asking questions about what it is they believe, how they came to those beliefs, what's been true in their life that would have maybe influenced that belief. And it's not a questioning of themselves to say, oh, I'm wrong. It's just, I want to know where I came from, like where I got the makeup of who I am, what's been influencing that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can do that, then you can better articulate why you believe something or how you came to that belief. those people then take that curiosity about themselves and they turn it on others. And they say, they're still in their mind, they're still getting introspective and questioning within themselves, but they start asking questions about others. Well, if I believe that, how might somebody who grew up differently than me, or who had different influences than me, or lived in a different neighborhood than me, how might they experience the world? They then follow that curiosity about others to go find out actual answers from those people. They ask questions of others that eventually leads them to have a more complex, nuanced understanding of an issue that they, again, couldn't possibly have all the answers to. It's just not possible. And they understand that. That's the kind of person I want to be. Mm. And I don't get it right all the time. I certainly have my snap judgments and my opinions about things that—
Oh, they're fun.
Well, and it makes you feel good and right and righteous. And it's really deeply uncomfortable work to question yourself.
Righteous indignation is a wonderful feeling.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Boy, does it make you feel important.
You made reference to you grew up Christian and you still are. Does that give you a backstop to lean, like, you know, no further than that there are some— one can question everything, and is there some territory that beyond which you will not go, or you think you should not go because of that upbringing, because of that faith, because of that belief, whatever that language is?
Yeah. If there is, I haven't found it yet.
Cool.
My faith looks probably very different than a lot of Christians. and I don't say that to prop myself up. It is just, there is a culture in Christianity, especially here in the United States, that we don't question things.
Right.
That's not being faithful.
Right.
I take the other tactic. I think God wants our questions. I think God wants our uncertainty, because how could we possibly be certain in an everlasting, eternal God? Like, if we got to the point where we weren't asking questions about what it means to believe, what our faith looks like, what the Bible says, what a relationship with Jesus looks like, what prayer looks like, how it's supposed to be done, how church is supposed to be done. If we get to the point where we're no longer asking questions about that, we have placed our God in a box and say, you are no bigger than this. And yet we claim to believe in a God that created the universe.
It's interesting.
I'm willing to go anywhere with you on that. Yeah. Because that's exactly, like, I'm doing that right now with my faith. And I think a lot of the questions that I'm asking about my faith would be very off-putting to a lot of people, because I'm questioning things that, you know, I'm almost 39 years old now. For 35 years of my life growing up and being in church and growing up in church, we did not ask these questions.
Right.
So let me give you an example. I know I'm speaking in, like, big terms here, but one of the big questions that I'm asking myself, David, is the way that sin is defined by a lot of Christians is very, very action oriented. You do this thing or you don't do this thing. And if you don't do this thing the right way, the way that the Bible says, or the way that your pastor says, that's living in sin. I have been exploring and kind of asking questions of myself, of God in prayer, of pastors who I know and trust, who I can have these kinds of conversations with. What if sin was actually the distance away from your relationship with God? What if living in sin was you were further away from having a relationship with God? And the closer you were to God, to having that relationship, to being in community with God, what if that made you less of a sinful person? And it, because if you live in a relationship with God, then your life will look differently. Like, let's take the Ten Commandments. if you have a relationship with God, are you gonna lust after someone else? Probably not, because you're going to see that they were divinely created. You're going to see that they have their own righteousness, their own bodily autonomy as a creation, as a created being. Are you going to murder? Well, no, you're not going to. Are you going to be greedy? Probably not, because you know that through your relationship with God, you've got sustaining all the sustainment that you need, and that you don't need these material things. You can want better for yourself, but it doesn't have to go into the greed. So one of the questions that I'm asking is, what is sin? And is it defined as the act of not doing something, or doing something that is not okay? Or is it our distance from God? Just one of the, I know, yeah, it's not perfect, but these are the questions that I'm willing to go in. And these are the questions that I am asking myself, because it is that deeply important to me.
That's great. Did you think you'd be speaking about this today?
On a show like Curiosity Invited, I had to have known at some level
there it is.
It was going to be possible.
Well, I'm looking at the time, because I know you have, yours is limited and mine is as well. And so maybe there's a part two.
Maybe there's a part two. I also think there's
more deeply into that conversation.
Yeah, I also think there's a need to get you on my show here, David. So
you just ask, and that would be fun. That would be fun.
Absolutely.
Well, Michael Ashford, thank you. Follow up conversation. Thanks so much for doing this. We barely scratched the surface about Daryl Davis and Jeff Smith.
I know it.
It's just like, you know, so there clearly will be a part two.
Let's do it. So, because those two are some of my biggest inspirations. I mean, if you want to understand the psychology of change, go listen to them.
Absolutely.
Go listen to them talk.
The willingness to, and what everybody knows is impossible. How could it possibly be that, you know, those two fellows are friends, or that, you know, Daryl is friends with a former Grand Wizard? How could that be? And if that's possible, why are Democrats and Republicans fighting? What a stupid idea.
You're asking some important questions there, David.
Well, Michael, thank you. It's actually great to get to know you, and great to meet you. So
thank you, sir.
So thanks so much, and have a good rest of your day.
Absolutely. You too.
Right. You too. Take care.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.